Okay, welcome to the Routing SIG. Where are the slides? Yes, there are the slides. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Routing SIG. This is the first of two sessions of the Routing Special Interest Group. Fortunately, we're competing a little bit with the Routing and Operations track, but such is the scheduling that we have with the conference the size of Apricot. Randy Bush and I are the chairs of this special interest group. Randy is, he was somewhere here. Where's he gone? Oh, he's right. Okay, hiding at the back. Randy and I are co-chairs of this special interest group. We hope we've got together an interesting enough program for you all. I would like to start off really by thanking all the speakers who have volunteered their content and the time to participate in this session. Mailing list, if you're interested in subscribing, and if you're not already a member, is as on the screen. It's sig-routing@list.apnic.net, and you can subscribe to that through the APNIC mailman system. So we don't actually have any action items on the Routing SIG, which is fine, so we don't have to look through any of those. So all we really need to do now is start with the actual presentations. And first up, we have David Hughes, who will be talking about BGP convergence.
Thanks, Phil. Right, as Phil mentioned, the general subject matter is BGP convergence. More specifically, I want to cover better handling of what we've been calling silent peer failures. It's something that is growing more and more important as more and more people are taking up services delivered over some of the newer technologies by telcos. One small apology I'll make before I get started is that the networks that I'm involved with running are predominantly very Cisco-centric. Where possible, I've tried to determine through public documentation the availability of certain features for Junipers, but obviously without exposure to the equipment and the software, some of it may not be accurate. But every effort has been made to provide as much detail as possible. So the basic overview of the presentation, just a quick overview of what we term a silent peer failure, and then a look at some of the technologies that have been worked on by various groups that in the future will hopefully make this a problem of the past. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, they are technologies of the future, so we'll have a quick look at what can be done to help with the problem now, and then I'll present some operational experience from what we've done with those tweaks. But a quick overview of what we term a silent peer failure. Okay. Normal network situation, a couple of routers. Unfortunately, these days, and more often than not, you will not have a direct layer 2 connection between the two devices. With the prevalence of technologies such as Metro Ethernet, we're seeing that the chances of you having a layer 2 connectivity, any sort of DC continuity between the two devices, is getting lower and lower. So in this situation, we have router A, router B connected via a switch, BGP session between them, and in this situation, B has got a default route from A, and A being the next hop. At some point in time, the link between A and the switch disappears. Of course, router B still has an up interface and will quite happily then continue forwarding traffic to what it thinks is still a very valid next hop. Obviously, router A not being there, that traffic is just going to be black-holed for quite some time, unfortunately. The concern here is the time it takes BGP to actually determine that is no longer a valid path. So that's what we're terming a silent peer failure, when the sending router has absolutely no idea that the peer's gone away. So the main problem with this is that the time to detect the lack of the peer is ridiculously long. Looking through the BGP spec, we've got two timers that are of interest. We've got the hold timer, and the keep live timer. The hold timer being the maximum number of seconds that the peer will wait between either receiving an update message or a keep live message from its peer. The hold timer is actually a negotiated value. When the session is established, the two boxes will specify what they would like to use for the hold timer, and the lower of those two values will be used within reason. The keep alive timer is historically set at 1/3 of the hold timer, and if a device hasn't sent an update message within that time frame, it should send a keep alive to keep the session active. The problem is that standard implementations that we commonly see on devices are using ridiculously large values for these timers. Cisco in particular, the default configuration of an iOS box, the keep alive timer is set at 60 seconds, giving you a hold time of 180 seconds. If you lose that peer silently, you can and will black hole your traffic for up to 179 seconds. Junipers are much better. In fact, they run 30-second timers with a 90-second hold timer, and that is actually compliant with the RFC. The RFC does specify, or does recommend, it doesn't specify, but it does recommend 30-second keep alives. So the fact that even at the best situation with on default configs on a Juniper, you're still going to black hole traffic for 89 seconds in a worst case scenario. If you're sitting there trying to offer your classic 5.9 reliability that everybody's striving to achieve, even however unrealistic that may be, giving you 316 seconds per year of downtime, you can't possibly have the situation that you might black hole traffic for up to 179 seconds running standard Cisco timers. If you offer any SLAs like that, you cannot possibly run standard timers. So how can we get around these problems? There are a couple of things coming out that do help. And an obvious one that is being made more and more available in various iOS releases is next hop tracking for BGP. The whole premise being that it's event driven from your IGP, and if the next hop of prefixes that are in your RIB are removed from your IGP, then they'll be dropped. There's no waiting for the timers to expire, and for your internal network, it's a very good solution. It's basically a fundamental premise of routing that your next hop should be reachable, and it's quite astounding that it's taken this long for something as simple as keeping an eye on the next hop to reach what is mainstream routing platforms. The downside, however, is that obviously that's not so good for your eBGP sessions unless you're running an iBGP upstream, which is obviously not going to be happening. From my reading of the documents, Juniper has no such mechanism at this point in time, and I hope I would stand corrected on that, but from my readings, that's not the case. To make it worse, it's very limited on iOS at this point in time. Shown there is the list of releases or trains where you'll find it. Unfortunately, for people who do a lot of aggregation using 6500s, there's no sign of it there yet. So it's a good feature, but it's certainly not widely acceptable at this point in time. Another emerging technology that helps considerably is bidirectional forwarding detection. BFD, for those who haven't come across it before, it's basically a very aggressive hello protocol. It's designed specifically to run where possible between the forwarding planes of the devices, leaving the control planes out of the equation. The premise there being that if the control plane gets busy for whatever reason, it doesn't have an impact on the forwarding plane's ability to talk to each other to maintain the consistency of that circuit. The way it's been implemented, it works over basically anything you can think of, directly attached connections, tunnels, MPLS, you name it, it works over it. And it's the reading through the RFCs, it's designed to be very aggressive. The timer values can be specified, as it shows up there, in microseconds. The nice thing is that the two main guys behind the ITF draft, we've got one from Cisco, one from Juniper, and these guys are all pushing it as being something that everybody should have. So hopefully that will mean we'll see some reasonably widespread deployment. And as I mentioned, that's a very good solution for your eBGP sessions. Unfortunately, it'll only be a good solution for eBGP sessions if you're upstream supported. And sitting in particularly in this country, I'm not quite sure how long it will take to see perhaps our monopoly telco provide something like BFD on its sessions. Another slight negative for BFD is that it does require some interaction backup, obviously, to the routing protocols. So there are different standards being written, once again, through the ITF working groups on the interaction between BFD and BGP and ISPF and ISIS. As far as trying to get any support for BGP, it's incredibly limited. Up there it shows you the platforms where you might be able to find it. Mostly we're seeing that it's being deployed for IGPs only at this state, which doesn't help us a lot. If we had next hop tracking, being able to yank prefixes out of the RIB from an IGP failure, that would be great, but we really need this for BGP as well. If you want to, you can jump in at 12.4T if you can find an image where the ink's not wet still, and you get it for BGP in there as well. Similarly, if you have a CRS1 lying around not doing anything, you can have it there too. I didn't have one at the time of testing. So a general solution for today, I mean, the underlying fundamental problem here is that the value of the timers that we inherit by the default configurations of our routing devices are insanely long. So the obvious solution is to just decrease the timers. We had a bit of debate on one of the public Cisco-oriented service provider mailing lists about my proposition that this was a good idea, and one participant in particular was pushing forward the argument that using a higher level mechanism like BGP timers to try to detect an underlying link failure was fundamentally flawed, which I must admit, it certainly is. However, at this point in time, if there is no other mechanism, I don't see what choice we have. iOS supports configuration stanza within the BGP stanza to actually tweak the timers to whatever you wish. So you can drop them to whatever you want to run, either internally or externally, to try to get your way around this problem. Only problem is that your upstream, if you're doing this externally, has every right to reject your session if it doesn't like the values you've presented. The RFC specifies quite clearly that 2 or below isn't an option, and it will definitely reject it there. However, up until very recently, there has been no way for the upstream to actually reject it based on the time. There's a very recent 12.0s release for iOS that actually has a new knob that's been attached to it, so you can configure on a peer what you believe would be a reasonable minimal value for the hold timer. But as I said, that's only very recently been added. It's only in 12.0s, nothing newer, and hopefully that won't get too far out there into the wilderness. Juniper doesn't have any such feature, so hopefully that means that we should be able to tweak our timers down to something more reasonable without our upstreams getting angry with us. Internally, if you have large aggregation routers, then once again it might increase a little bit of load on that, and that might be something to keep an eye on. However, we haven't seen anything dramatic. And if you're running incredibly aggressive timers, then obviously you might see some issues if the router gets very busy. We haven't had any problems like that. We've been running this in production for quite some time now. We did some trials, we labbed it, and it worked fine. And under all the stress testing we could find, including direct DOS attacks at the boxes in question, and we didn't see any instability of the peer sessions. So we rolled it out around our upstreams. Web Central has connectivity to basically all tier one upstreams. There's giggies going all over the place, so we face this problem where we don't get link to our upstreams all over the place. We're running 5-second keep alives, giving us a maximum 14-second black holing if we do experience a silent failure, and we haven't seen a single issue so far. Because we have no next hop tracking internally for our IBGP sessions, we're actually looking at rolling this out internally on 1-second keep alives within the network itself. We haven't done so as yet, but it's certainly something we're going to be trialling in the very near future. And we think it'll give us something a little bit closer to what we need until the other features become available. So in summary, we do have a light at the end of the tunnel. This is a problem that hopefully will be relegated to history once people get on board the likes of BFD and providing us IGP-based next hop tracking in more commonly used releases. But this is a very good interim solution. And the, as I said, the 3x5 second keeper lives that we've been using have been working very well. And if you're happy to run Cisco default values, then you obviously don't care about passing of reliable passing of your traffic. Any questions?
Are there any questions for David? In my haste to get the meeting started, I forgot to do the housekeeping list. But if there are any questions for David, can the questioners please come up to the microphone, state name and affiliation before you ask your question?
Excellent.
No, nothing at all. Thank you very much, everyone. Okay, while Jeff is setting up for his routing update presentation, I will go through the housekeeping list that I omitted to do at the start. So as I was saying, if people want to ask questions at the end of the presentation, please come up to the microphone. I think there's also a travelling microphone wandering around as well if you're not mobile. State your name and affiliation. Again, for the benefit of the microphone. Also, I should point out that this session is being broadcast and audiocasted, so it even makes it more important that people use the microphone so that the people who have joined us from elsewhere can actually hear what's being talked about. Afternoon tea, of course, is in the Level 2 foyer area, so it's basically that way to your, well, to my left, to your right. The social event is this evening. If you've got your ticket, please bring your ticket. And the details of where it is are listed on the back of the ticket. APNIC staff will collect the ticket from you when you board the bus. And that will actually leave, the bus that is, will leave from Level 1 Plaza Deck outside. The last bus will be 10 past 7, so please don't miss it. Next item, my APNIC and the policy flash demo are running all day at the APNIC help desk. The help desk is available during break times, so that will be the morning, lunchtime, afternoon breaks. On-site notice board, again, it's advised to have a look at the on-site notice board and the APNIC website just for any last-minute updates and so forth. And there's a special session, 4 p.m. today in meeting room 3, discussing the APNIC fee structure. So that's an open session. Anyone with an interest in that topic is welcome to attend and is invited to participate in the discussions, although I'd much prefer you to come to the writing SIG, but that's up to you. Anyway, that's the housekeeping. So the next presenter is Jeff, who will be giving us a routing update.
I will. Thank you. Good afternoon. I seem to do these at every routing SIG of giving you an idea of what's happening inside the BGP routing table. I've actually got three parts to this presentation today. One is a status report, and then I'm actually looking at some work based on a question that Vince Fuller asked me a few months ago that I found particularly interesting to try and answer, and then some further observations after that. So normally I use hourly snapshots that I pull from route views, but this time to get some of the data together, I actually used a complete dump of all of the BGP updates logged in AS1221. So I have to thank Stefan Millett of Telstra for actually giving me a copy of the entire BGP updates for AS1221 for 2005. My disk is now full, thank you. Usual picture. This is 2005, January through February, the BGP prefixes. And it might look like November and December were tailing off, but be assured that January and February of this year, you've come back again and routing is back on once more. What does that look like? Well, you can put a line across it and go, well, okay, the number of prefixes in the default free zone across last year rose from 150,000 to 175,000 prefixes in 12 months, approximately. So, you know, life is still increasing the way it always was. The amount of address space is kind of interesting. 4.4 billion addresses in IPv4 if you actually try and use them all. We started at 1.36 billion addresses at the start of the year and finished at 1.5-ish. Those big jumps there, there are still two slash 8s that appear and disappear like lighthouses. I'm like, it just amazes me still that there are slash 8s that flap. But there are slash 8s that flap, and there they are. So, you know, you can draw a line across the top of this, and what I've done is eliminated the slash 8, smoothed it out. And what you actually see is then pretty cleanly that the amount of address space rose from 1.36 to about 1.5 billion addresses. Some seasonal variation. Some of you took holidays over the Northern Hemisphere summer, and you were slightly below average, but when you got back to work in October, you decided to add more addresses into the network. So we appreciate that, and thank you. The total number of AS numbers, it's the same kind of curve. I make again, here's the year. Very consistent. Unlike address space, AS number appearances on the net just keep on romping through. So the trend line is actually really spot on from 18,500 up to now 21,000. Somehow ASs are just remarkably consistent, unlike addresses or routing table entries. The ASs that keep on appearing just appear almost like clockwork. Quite strange. So the vital statistics, right? The prefix is up by 18%. Now, roots and more specifics. Are we getting better or worse at this whole business of actually only advertising the aggregate? And the answer is, well, no, no better and no worse. Because the number of basic root advertisements that, if you will, encompass new space rose by 18% to 85,000, 85,500. But the number of more specifics, predominantly slash 24s, but, you know, a few others in the mix, also rose by about the same amount. So around 50% of the network is still more specifics and around 50% of basic root prefixes. The amount of prefixes rose by 18%. The amount of addresses only rose by 10%. So as you can figure it out from that, the granularity of advertisements getting smaller, not larger, again. So yes, you know, lots of little advertisements because the address base is not growing as quickly. Number of AS numbers up by 14%. So what can I say? The average advertisement size is smaller. The address origination per AS is getting smaller. So ASs are moving down the food chain. Interestingly, the average AS path length, which I haven't shown you, is remarkably steady at 3.5 ASs. 14% more ASs, but the diameter of the network is constant. The density of interconnection is actually increasing. It's actually an interesting question whether this is uniform density increase or whether there are black points where the amount of density is really increasing. In other words, are exchange points and similar of their ilk actually gaining strength, or is the bombing out of the long distance transit fibre market causing interconnection to appear across longer spans? Some work is happening, I think, in Adelaide right now in a research group there around topology of the network, and I'd be keen to see if they're working on that because I think it's actually an interesting issue. Why? Because the denser the mesh, the more badly BGP behaves when it tries to converge. So trying to understand if the explosions are local or global is actually probably an interesting thing to understand. However, on the macro level, the network is getting denser. The advertisement granularity is getting smaller, more interconnections, more specifics. By contrast, this was V6. Similar graph, except you've got to look at the numbers. The number of prefixes rose from a phenomenal 700 to a phenomenal 868, I believe. Well done. Thank you. And more patchy. I'm like, and you can obviously see that people, you know, decided that summer was a bad time. When they got back to work in August, they mucked around with V6 and then got bored. That's August over there. And then, you know, after that, they all went home again. More noisier. The advertised address span. This is weird. Two big spikes and everything going down. In other words, the blue line is actually decreasing each time. Why is that? Why is that? I took away the six bone, and now what you actually see, and this is this issue, that a slash 20 is much, 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 much bigger than a slash 32. So here are all the slash 32s, blip, slash 20. In fact, I think it's a slash 21, that's a slash 20. So it's actually really hard to show you the growth in V6 address space, apart from saying two whacking great big allocations sort of happened that year and got advertised, and there were a few little ones, but you can't see them. So there's the six bone. You've now got precisely 4 months to quit, and so far some of you are quitting. Each jump down is a slash 24. So yes, the six bone is slowly being turned off. Here's that combined view now. I don't know if it's any clearer, but you know, that's the big picture. That's the bit that gets left after six bone, and that's the six bone slowly flying off. And without those two big allocations being advertised, that's what we actually had. You just can't see it. Someone's given me a laser pointer. So that's the bit without the big allocations. Advertised AS numbers, noisier. Probably because 500 to 600. So there are 600 of you playing in the V6 game, as far as I can see, some in six bone, some not. So what can I tell you about this? Prefix is up by 21%, roots by 15, more specifics by 51. Naughty, naughty, naughty. You're not meant to disaggregate in V6. Stop it. The amount of address space went up by a phenomenal 50%, but you saw it's because two allocations actually happened to be advertised and went straight up. And AS is up by 20%. The average advertisement size as a result of those two massive ones is getting enormously large, and origination per AS is getting large, but only because of those two factors. The path length I really can't give you much of a view on. It's just such a small network that you really can't see what the average AS path length is. And the interconnection degree, I just can't tell. So as far as I can see, this is a network that continues to go largely over overlays at the edges, and trends really aren't there yet. Part one. Part two, more interesting. If you were buying a router and you'd like it to live for 3 years inside your network doing what it's doing and it's trying to run in the default free zone, what spec would you tell the vendor to build to? You know, how many prefixes? How many prefix updates per second? Vince actually wanted me to answer two questions, V4 and V6, and I took the easy one out and did V4. I actually find it very hard to predict V6, as I told you before, because it's just such a small network, I really can't tell. But I'd actually like to try and have a shot at this answer in a V4 context. And for this, I'm actually taking a macro view. So I've taken the entire set of update and withdrawals from AS1221 for 2005. Now, because you're inside a relatively busy network, there's a whole bunch of local updates also happening from inside the network. So I've basically tried to filter out everything that I don't think came from the default free zone. So smacked out a whole bunch of updates from there. And what I'm trying to do is to see if I can relate the number of updates and withdrawals against the number of entries in the RIB. And at the same time, I'm also looking at the CPU load records from that router that was supplying all the updates. And again, try and see if there's a relationship between the amount of CPU that's being used in that router on some kind of granularity against the table size. Now, if that's the case, if you can do a table size predictive model and you know the relative number of updates and withdrawals in CPU, you have a vague idea of how big the thing should possibly be somewhere in 3 to 5 years' time. So that's the methodology here of trying to answer that question. Updates per day for the year in millions. The fault-free zone. So I filtered out a fair few. At the start of the year, somewhere around 300,000 updates per second, BGP update messages were being caught at the router. By the end of the year, it was slightly under 600,000. That's big. That's an enormous amount of updates. Notice also that this is not uniform. Now, the law of very, very big numbers says that if each of you contribute a little, and there are 21,000 ASs, that line should be smooth. So the law of large numbers isn't working. The variation on that number is so big, up to 50%, that I suspect that each of you aren't contributing a little. And that's what I want to talk about a bit later. So, yes, notice that astonishing variation. That is not nice. Number of prefixes per update message. How efficient are we at packing prefixes into single updates? Getting worse. In other words, the update is getting closer and closer to describing just one prefix, not a bulk of them. In other words, the network, in terms of the routing policy granularity and updates, is increasing. Granularity is getting smaller. And again, the number of prefixes per update vary a lot. Some folk are doing very strange things. I'm trying to understand that. So, number of update messages per day, unfortunately, is close to doubled. And as I said, it's really highly variable and it shouldn't be. Number of prefixes per update message is falling. And I'm just wondering if this is actually due to this increasing use of ASs to do multi-homing at the edge. That I'm actually seeing what used to be an ISP with 50 prefixes is now an AS with 20 and a whole bunch of ASs underneath it that actually is starting to multi-home. But for some reason or other, you know, the number of prefixes per update is falling. And now I'm trying to actually understand, it seems to be that the update rate is increasing faster than the table rate. That update rate was almost double. So in other words, the number of updates happening in the network is increasing faster than the table size. is there some kind of multiplicative factor going on? Or there's something else here. There's some kind of instability that seems to be getting larger, even larger than the routing table itself. This is not good news. So now, maybe if I stop looking at update messages and actually start looking at individual prefixes. How many prefixes change per day? And what's their trends? So what I've done now, instead of looking at update messages, I'm actually looking at prefixes. These are updates, those are withdrawals in millions. So the withdrawals, 200,000 going up to 300,000 in a day. Huge number of withdrawals. The updates of prefixes is even noisier. This is weird. I can put a trend line on the prefix update rates, and, you know, yes, it has increased. Around 800,000 update prefix messages. You know, the prefixes that actually got updated each day by the end of the year. Withdrawal rates, you can actually start to see that is an exponential line. And even though it's noisy, there's clearly an exponential growth factor in the withdrawal rates. So, high variability and approximately exponential, but at different rates. The updates are growing faster than the withdrawals. So now, can I relate that to the size of the network? The actual number of entries in the network itself. So that's the default free zone across the year. That's 100,000, that's 170,000. And you can see pretty clearly there that that's not linear now. It really is a bend going on there. I've smoothed it out, and I've done a first order differential. The default free zone in terms of number of entries in the RIB is growing faster than linear and is actually growing order n squared. So if I look at it as an order 2 polynomial, how many RIB entries in 3 to 5 years, Vince? Well, somewhere between 275,000 in 3 years and 375,000 in 5 years would be a prediction. My guess of the confidence interval is about 20%, so it's not that confident. But that fit isn't bad. So that appears to be, if you're looking at a 3 to 5 year, that appears to be the kind of metric you're looking at. Now, I've done the next thing, which is for each RIB entry, 100,000, whatever, how many updates per RIB entry over the year? If that was linear, then that would be growing at the same rate as the table itself. If it's more than linear, then the number of prefixes being altered each day is growing faster than the table size. And this is the number of withdrawals per RIB entry. Isn't that weird? One withdrawal per RIB entry. On average, every day, the entire table is withdrawn. Or there are a very small number of prefixes that are doing an awful lot of work. Withdraw, update. But that's one. Every single entry is updated 3 times every day, or there's a small number of prefixes that are, you know, pushing up an awful lot of iron very quickly. And that's growing very fast. And again, very noisy. So I can answer you at least at a gross level here, Vince, as to what I think is going to happen on the withdrawal and update rate. Inside 3 years, you're going to have to cope with around 1.7 million prefixes being changed every day. And by 5 years, that will grow up to, you know, around 3 million, which is, you know, a minor amount. And the withdrawal rate, similarly, should be around 1.5 million withdrawals per day, which should keep your routers busy. How fast will your router have to spin? Again, same kind of technique. I got from Steph the actual 5-minute and 1-minute CPU loads. And across the year, the router in question had a brain transplant twice. And this is, you know, some super dupe whiz-bang router. What is it? A PRP2? PRP2. That's a PRP2. Isn't it cool? So what I tried to do was normalize that and make everything a PRP2. So what I actually got here was this. This is what happened across the year. That the 1-minute load rate on the PRP2 increased by that rate and just pushed it up per RIB entry. So this is growing faster than the RIB. So again, what it appears to be that when I push that forward, if I'm doing a unit of 1 by the end of this year, by the end of 5 years, I'll need 4 times that amount of processing power to cope with that load, appears to be the projection. So here's my first sort of set of answers here, that today at 176,000 prefixes, 700,000 update rates per day, withdrawals at 400,000. You probably need around a quarter of a gig of memory, and you probably are going to use, to be on the safe side, 30% of a 1.5 gig processor. 3 years' time, 275,000 prefixes, just under three times the update rate, 1.7, almost a million withdrawals. You're probably going to need double the memory, and you're probably going to consume 75% of that processor. And in 5 years, you'll need a new processor, absolutely, about 120%. Seems awful low, actually. And I think it is low, because you really are talking about trying to cope with peaks. Convergence is about speed rather than reliability in some sense. You've got to get there faster. So it's per second peak rates, not average loads, that actually really is the problem. And they also assume that BGP isn't going to change. And certainly there's been more than enough words around over the last year or two that we need to do something around securing BGP. If you think you need to be able to do that inside 5 years' time, then you may want to think about what exactly are the factors here in the router you're going to buy in terms of security-related protocols. Are we doing IPsec in our peering or something similar? What happens in security-related payroll factors, incremental workload, and so on? So I would actually say that if I was going to spec one out, I'd at least want 500,000 entries in the rib, no sweat. And that means, depending on the number of peering sessions, I'm going to need an awful lot of adjacency rib space. If I was going to be conservative and say, well, if I do this, then I think I'm okay, it's about 6 million prefix updates per day, and I would like the peak update rate to be 100 times the average per day. I think I need at least a 2 gig route processor memory and probably a 5 gig processor for route processing. And then I'm able to look at what security needs in above that. What was a Cray 1? I think a Cray 1 was less than that, wasn't it? Yeah, cool. How good is that number? What's going on here? I think I've got a couple more seconds. Is this uniform? I don't think so. I don't think all of you are behaving so well as that. Or is this skewed? And if so, how skewed? 289,000 prefixes were actually announced that were different. Now, the table is only 179,000 prefixes. So there are actually 127,000 prefixes that appeared for some period and aren't there anymore. So people are leaking, and then they pull it back. But there's been an awful lot of leaking. The number of prefixes that had no updates at all for a year, congratulations, were 12,640. Well done. Gold star and a tick. Elephant stamp. And everyone else doesn't. They did some kind of update. This is a cumulative histogram of what's going on. 50% of the prefixes contributed less than 10% of the updates. 60% of the prefixes contributed less than 20%. 80% of the prefixes contributed just on 20%. So the top 20% of the prefixes were pretty bad, and the top 1% contributed 15% of the update load. Okay, let's name them. So if you see yourself on this list, you're on this list for one of two reasons. One, you're multi-homing and you don't know how. Because somehow you managed 158,000 prefixes for the year, of which 20,000 were actually just flips in the first hop AS, the next hop. And of course, you flapped like crazy. All of these folk flapped. Some of them also rehomed as well. So have a look there. You may be there. You may wonder why you're there. If you're there and you wonder why you're there, go to the tutorials. Let's have a look at these people, because some of them are systematic and some of them are just nighttime stuff-ups. Systematic, Hong Kong SuperNet. This is a prefix that was actually active with draw update. The green is the flap. The red is an attribute change. So for a period of at least 4 months, this one prefix managed to generate around 1,500 update messages per day for one prefix, most of which will withdraw, announce, withdraw, announce, withdraw, announce. Precisely what information that added or subtracted from the routing table beats me with a stick. Somehow they got a clue in September. Well done. Here's another one. This is from iCare.com in Hong Kong. This is traffic engineering. This is just straight traffic engineering. This is Hong Kong SuperNet again. They have four upstreams, and they're moving prefixes around. This is one in Turkey. Someone out there in Vendorland sold them something in June that they shouldn't have bought. Because this is systematic, sustained, 500 updates a second, and predominantly first, it's moving across multiple upstreams. This one is an interesting case. Here's another one from Turkey. They went and bought even more of it at the end of September and did even better with it. Why is this? Again, here's another one, Amphibian Media. I think they're related to Internap, the folk who do inbound route traffic engineering. And here is another one, Merit. Surely they should know better. I looked for this network a couple of days ago and it's gone. You know, they must have seen it flapping and sent it off into routing hell, because 207.25.155, I couldn't see a week or so ago. Phenomenal amount of updates from folk like Merit. And here's the last one again. Oh, it's the friends from Turkey. They really did buy something in June. I think they tested it in April and really turned it on in June. It just shouldn't have happened any other way. Vera Center in the US, and number 10, again a US one, I think they're internet related. Systematic, absolutely systematic. So this is no accident. Is it prefixes or is it autonomous systems? Look at that curve. This is the autonomous system one. Go back by 10, look at this one. So while there might be a small number of prefixes creating all these updates, there's a tiny number of autonomous system numbers generating all these updates. The top 1% here, the top 2%, the top 3%, 3% of the autonomous system numbers generated half of the updates. Thank you very much. Well done. Here's another way of looking at it. These red is the actual number of updates. The green is just the top 50 ASs. So the top 50 ASs do half the updates. 50 people cause your router to have a problem. 50 people cause BGP to have a problem. So let's name them. Here's the first one, AS9121. We met them before, the folk who bought this wonderful thing in June. 206,000 rehomes inside effectively 6 months. If they'd been running it for the year, they would have been off the planet as number one. They're just now mildly on top. And so on. You can see there's an awful lot of multi-homing in 9121, 702, 17557, and 721. 721 probably should know better. And an awful lot of flaps on all of them. Here's the signature for our friends in Turkey of the total number of prefixes they originate. And yes, they actually tried it in February, liked what they saw. I think they really bought it in April, turned it on hard in June, took a holiday over August, came back to work, and then something blew up in December. This is bad stuff. I actually had a look at them. They seem to have six upstreams. And my guess is that they're using a tool like OER and they're doing more specific juggling to try and get their incoming traffic evenly balanced. And my suspicion is that they could stop all this if they bought more bandwidth. Because what's going on, as far as I can see, and you can look them up in BGP Play and have fun with these guys, but you will find that the routes flip across all six at 4 a.m. Now, I know that these are probably hardworking ISPs, but I don't think anyone's up there at 4 a.m. doing massive config changes, you know, as fast as they can type. There is some automated system inside this particular AS that's doing bad things globally. So, you know, more tutorials and a word of caution to the vendor. You shouldn't have sold it to them, whatever you sold it to. Whatever you bought, sell them. The next one, Korea Internet Exchange, number 2. This is not traffic engineering. This is something like med oscillation or some other pathological condition that lasted for a while, caught it and fixed it. MCI Europe, traffic engineering. Pakistan Telecom, a combination of the two? I can't tell. These enormous spikes are weird, but there's also a background of activity. So that's probably harder to actually put a signature on. Oh, Hong Kong SuperNet, our friends. Whatever it was stopped in September, and we're all very grateful. TPG here in Australia, again, you know, they're number 6 on the list. Really high spikes intermittently. Can't figure it out yet. 9121, that's our friends in the US military. Something must have happened in June. Somewhere. that required a huge amount of updates in BGP. Hong Kong SuperNet has two ASs, and here's the second one. So they just keep on having more fun than you can imagine. And DACOM in Korea. And last but not least, KR, Korea National Computerisation Agency. Those are individual problems that just actually happened over a few days. So what are we seeing? We're not seeing a level of uniformity in update rates that my answer to Vince was any good at all. I'm actually only looking at 100 ASs, I believe. And I'm looking at 100 ASs whose behaviour pattern is pathologically bad. And they contribute the overwhelming bulk of updates now and have done for at least a year. And I suspect there's two reasons. One, there's a whole bunch of automated inbound traffic engineering software that does route prefix juggling, that is stuffing up the entire network with millions of updates and withdrawals. Literally millions, in fact hundreds of millions. That sustained, consistent update rate is killing us. So if you really want to do inbound traffic engineering, consider buying more bandwidth instead. The rest of us will thank you. Because I don't think the routing system can withstand that kind of abuse. And secondly, there's something more than med oscillation. When you look at med oscillation, as far as I can tell, you should never see a withdrawal. It just simply flicks. Whereas what I'm seeing in these unstable ones that burst for 24 hours up to 48 hours is actually a massive number of withdrawals associated with moving around with the prefix. So we do have isolated incidents of up to a week of just unstable configurations that somehow are just causing massive load rates. So as I said, the overwhelming number of updates are being generated by an underwhelming number of sources. The uncertainty in the trend models I just gave you is actually extremely high. And that means that if you really want me to give you an answer, Vince, on what you need to buy in 3 to 5 years, my answer is I don't have a clue. Thank you.
Randy Bush, IJ. Jeff, two things. Why did you throw out the internal route fluctuations when the router is going to have to handle them?
Oh, this was the question as distinct from the investigation. The question was actually asked if I was buying a default free zone router. And when I start factoring in AS1221, how do I sort of know that that's a
typical
kind of pattern? So I actually thought the way to do this, and AS1221 doesn't have an awful lot of upstreams. So if you look at its topology, it's actually got a couple of domestic peers, and you also see just one upstream. So I'm kind of looking truly at a default-free zone single path, and that seemed to be a good baseline to take for these measurements. So it was, I suppose,
so
I did
this
that
is
to
what
answer
I
the question.
This is what I will need if I have a single router in the default-free zone that doesn't connect anything else.
So you should buy more.
I'm the null ISP.
So I'm talking about the floor, not the ceiling, yes.
Right, and let's realize, of course, Vince doesn't want to know what router he should buy, it's what router he should sell, since Vince is now at a vendor. The other thing is those slash eights you saw flapping that you don't understand. I gave a lightning talk at the end of the last NANOG for Nick Feemster, where we discover that there are a number of slash eights being used by spammers. They announce the slash eight. They hit you with spam from the dark space in it, from the unused space in it, and withdraw the slash eight. And that's those flapping slash eights.
Thank you. We should name them. I'm not sure it'll do any good because they're actually stolen. Oh, okay, you named them in your talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're stolen. In other words, they cover existing allocateds. And
right. They cover some sparse allocations, and what they're doing is they're using it for agile spam generation. So they announce the slash eight, and they go ping, 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 withdraw.
Interesting. Thank you.
Any other questions for Jeff? I think if not, we should move on. We're a little bit behind in time, so thanks very much, Jeff. So next up we have Randy, who will be talking about routing security from an ISP's perspective.
two, three. These systems are now automatic. This is just unbelievable. They actually work. Okie doke. Credit also to Steve Bellavin, a lot of whose work is represented here. What's routing security? It is not router security. It is not defending your router against attack that are similar to attacks that will happen to your Windows or real computer or whatever. It's the unique threat is attacking using the routing protocols. It's routing security, not router security. And what are they doing it for? To divert traffic and to alter traffic. And we have some ability to lessen the danger, but not enough. Okay, some history of routing security. Radia did a dissertation back in 88. Steve Bellavin published some stuff in 89. Work accelerated in 96. Steve Kent, who's I saw a moment ago, did some good stuff in 2000, and endless drawing in the Internet Vendor Task Force. Okay, why so little progress? The problems are technically difficult. Okay, simple routing, as Jeff just showed you, is not simple. Complex problems in routing are exceedingly complex. When some of the best computer scientists in the world are studying your stuff as a behavioral phenomenon, you should know you're in trouble. Okay? So, it's not traditional communication security. In other words, the stuff all the boys and girls in your big stack telcos know doesn't apply very well here. So, it's new ground. The installed base is big. And a transition problem is big, okay? And vendors aren't seeing people with big bucks saying, do it. Whether those people don't exist or the vendor's vision is poor is not clear. Normal operation security, please go to the tutorials. Okay, what do we want to ensure? That an ISP who announces something owns it. Origin of prefix. If a router announces a path to X, then it can actually deliver the packets there. And if it tells me it can get me to someplace, did someplace authorize it to take me there? If Rudiger tells me he can take me to Jeff, did Jeff want his traffic to go through Rudiger? We won't get into that, Jeff. Guys, we've known him for years. What the heck? Okay, what's different? As I said, the well-studied communication, host security issues, and buggy codes, et cetera, are all about buggy code or bad protocol design. In this case, we have as good protocol design as we can do, and the code is... Well, we won't go there, but we're still vulnerable because of a dishonest member of the game, somebody with whom we are connected, or somebody with whom we are connected to be connected, is lying. Okay? So hop-by-hop authentication is not sufficient because just because I have a secure connection to Jeff doesn't mean Jeff's a good guy. Okay, what does the attacker want? The normal situation is site A sends along this path a nice financial transaction from A to X to Y to B. Z, the attacker, wants to divert the traffic, strip off and keep the dollars, and let the traffic go there, maybe or maybe not, so that everybody thinks everything was fine and they kept the dollars. Well, of course, it may not be dollars. It could be critical information. It could be, well, we won't go there. All sorts of stuff. How does attacker do it? This is going to be a simplified model. I think the original title here was said this is an oversimplification, so excuse me. The routers select the lowest cost for some meaning of cost path towards a destination on a hop-by-hop basis. The attacker owns some router and he lies about the cost, and we must assume that random routers on the internet can be owned. The current price, going price, in the black hat market for the enabled password to an ISP router is 5 credit card numbers. That's pennies. Okay? So they own some of your routers today, or mine too. Okay? How does Z do it? Okay, there are some costs, so the path here is 5 plus 5 plus 5 is 15. I'm not going to go that way because it's 30. So, Y told Z that it was 10, and its cost to B was 5. Y says, I can get, told X and Z, I can get you to, if you can get it to me for 5, I can get you to B. X told A and Z that its costs are, I can get you to Y in 5 and B in 10. And similarly, Z tells X, these are the costs. Z lies and says, I can get you there cheaper. So the traffic gets handed to Z. And Z just got what he or she wanted. Why is it a hard problem? X does not really know what Z's links are. Has to believe what Z's saying. X does not really know what Y's links are either, and so they all trust each other regarding cost. Okay? Validating prefix ownership does not help, as nobody lied that B owned the target. Okay, using a routing registry like Peering Mac does not help because nobody lied about who connected to whom. Okay, one approach, and Steve gets credit for the underlying model, is that B cryptographically signs when it tells Y. It says, hey, hello, Y, you can get to my cost for B is 5. Okay? So it is signing forward when it announces. Y signs messages to X and B, X and Z, encapsulating B's message. Inside of its message is the message it received, signed by B, saying this cost, and it adds in front of it, I can get you to Y for 10. So I can get you to Y for 10, signed by Y. So Y is committing to that. And by the way, B, which you can verify, I am not making it up, because B created this signature, and only B could have created it. B can get you there for 5. Okay? Or pardon me, Y can get you to B for 5. So I can get you to Y for 10. Y can get you to B for 5. Z can only sign now that it can get to Y for 10 and Y can get to B for 5. It can't tell you the lie that it told you before. And you can verify this cryptographically. Okay? But there's costs. It's very CPU intensive. Okay? So, use caching. Use pre or delayed validation. Okay? The fact is, well, for those who had the misfortune to be in the database session and hear about my version of the PKI model a couple hours ago, you can validate, or even in Steve's model, you can validate who owns what. When you receive the database, you don't have to wait till you receive the routing announcement. Okay? And if you can't get it right now, be optimistic. Say, okay, I'll believe it for the moment, and go check it slowly, delayed validation. Hopefully computers will get a little faster. And as Jeff has just pointed out, most routing announcements are boring because you've already heard them recently. So if the router had a cache of what it had already validated, even though that was withdrawn, those people in Hong Kong are going to tell it to you again.
In the next second.
Don't forget it. You won't have to revalidate it. So, unfortunately, the expense is highest when routing is changing just when we need validation the most. But what Jeff just pointed out says probably that stuff is boring. Okay. Trust issues. How does X know the identity of ISPY? How does anyone know prefix ownership? Are the two core questions. So who owns the address space and who is announcing it? Okay, address space ownership and ASN ownership, by the way, both of them, luckily fall into a natural hierarchy with IANA at the root. And so IANA can assign allocations to the RIRs. RIRs can assign allocations to the ISPs, LIRs, NIRs, and XIRs. And using their certificates, and so on, down to end users. Who issues the certs? IANA can certify itself. It'll be the root cert. Who certifies an RIR or IANA? Who certifies an ISP's identity or an RIR? You know, is it a web of trust? Issuing the certificate of who owns that address space can be separated from issuing the certificate for the address space prefix. In other words, the ISP's identity is separable from the space that is being allocated to them. I've got a great foil in another prezzo. How are we for time?
You have 10 more minutes.
Oh, I'll make it easy. Okay. I'm going to do something horrible. I'm going to go to another prezzo if I can see here. And I don't have my glasses. Excuse me. Oh, this is horrible. Oh, I can use this to see. Yes. Okay. This is an allocation by APNIC. It is an allocation to me as the ISP. There's my identity and my public key. And it allocates that address space with that expiration. And APNIC signs the delegation. Sorry, Steve. You'll survive the experience.
I'm not sure about that.
I understand. We will have some opportunities to discuss this. Okay? And similarly, for an AS number it gives to me, and when I make the announcement, it's from one of the ASs I own, of address space I own, and you can verify it all. And, what were we in? We were in this one, and now we just have to say this. Okay, I did this. Okay, so how are the certs distributed? Is it administered administratively via FTP, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. LDAP v3 was specifically designed to hold these kind of certs. If it doesn't do a good job of it, then somebody should come up with LDAP v4, please. An out-of-band protocol, a cert distribution protocol. RFC 2585 says how you actually transact with a PKI to store, push and get certs. Okay? Is there an in-band protocol? There are some protocols that, there are some secure BGP suggestions that suggest that as yet another extension to BGP, and somebody will certainly think of how to do it with the DNS. Right? So, that was it. I made it. Steve Bellavin, by the way, did a lot of this work and helped me, NSF work, and of course IIJ pays my salary. Go for it, Steve. Here, take this one.
I liked most of it until we got to the, and we take these blobs and sign them. And unfortunately, the way you describe them doesn't correspond to any standard way of issuing certificates from a format perspective. Because you tied together, if you go back to the slide in whichever presentation that was. There. You either issue an identity cert or you issue an attribute cert, but the issuance of those are two separate signed thingies. So someone could issue an identity cert to any one of the players described here.
Or they could get it from anywhere.
They could get them from anywhere, and then someone else has the responsibility of figuring out whether or not that identity cert represents the people they're dealing with, and then issue them an attribute cert. And I guess the question that comes to mind is, why would I add that extra level of complexity,
cost,
and...
They already do that. When I contract with... Where's somebody from an RIR here, please? There we go. Sam, you're the victim. When I sign a contract with APNIC, that the paper part of the contract binds my identity.
It binds your identity in what space?
In real space. They have my physical address, my signature.
Sure.
That is a legally binding contract.
Sure.
And when I do that, I should hand them the certificate, which I will use to transact this stuff. That is my identity. And I assert that in the binding legal contract. I might have gotten that cert, 95% of the cases, by the way. Nobody wants to do their own cert management, you know, all the medium-sized and small ISPs, and they'll pay APNIC $10 Australian, and APNIC will give them their cert. Okay? But Telstra, Stephen, where are you? There we go. I believe paid tens of thousands of dollars to Thought or VeriSign or somebody to get a Telstra CA. And I am not going to tell Telstra how to do their internal security management. They are a 500-kilogram gorilla, and they're going to tell me how they want to do their security management. Okay? But what's interesting here is that they need no, the NSight, the identity certs of the ISPs or NSights need no attestation, because they're only used in two ways. They're only used either as a business transaction, you know, I sign a financial email that I send to Sam, or I sign a DNS request I send to Sam, or I signed an allocation request I send to Sam, and Sam, I signed it with the private key that matches the public key in the cert I gave her when I paid her money and made a contract. So that identity is assured.
I think the problem here is, and I may be misunderstanding, but they're twofold. One, if I, as a RIR, go to the trouble of issuing an attribute cert to someone, the work is exactly the same as if I issue them a public key cert. You don't get any bonus points for saying it's only an attribute cert.
Yes,
the difficulty
it doesn't
is the
work,
same.
But the attribute cert doesn't have a key, doesn't that's, have keys on it, and therefore I cannot use it to sign requests to them, and I can't use it to sign BGP announcements.
Right, but your slides have attribute certs in them.
That is
issued by people to bind resources to
identities.
The holder of
to an identity.
So, like I said, you've added this additional thing that a registry in this case had to do, and I'm not sure why one would add it, given that the work you have to do that is just as much as if you just issued them a cert with a public key in it, binding those resources in the first place.
Because it's what we really do in our operational world. This, just as I like SBGP, because it maps the BGP I know and is very congruent with it. I like this because it maps our actual transactions between the ISPs and between the ISPs and the RIRs. For instance, my identity will be the same, and the public key I will use, I will announce, will be the same for my transactions with APNIC and with, where's Aaron? Somebody around. Hey, there's an Aaron.
You can do that even if they issue you public key certs, because you always get to public key, choose the public key anyway.
Right, but so not you can if have it's the in same... the app, not if it's in the resource cert.
Yes, you can. Like I said, you as a holder, you as a subject of a cert, generally speaking, get to choose what your public key is. And if you choose to put that same public key in two resource certs, which are public key certs with resource extensions to them, like RFC 3779, you can choose to do that, and that won't break anything. The second concern, though, is that you said the only way you use the cert, the identity cert, is in a local transaction with the registry, for instance.
It's bound in the attestations, which then can be used in routing announcements.
The catch is you can only validate a public key cert by walking some chain from some trust anchor point. If you use the example you gave here of self-signed certs, everyone has to be a trust anchor for everyone else, which is a very significant
problem. No. When I get the BGP announcement from Jeff with the two of those objects, one being the ASN and one being the IP space, I go to the IP space and I chase the IP space, and I can verify the signatures all the way up to the IANA that encapsulated the attestations of who owned the space going up the tree.
If the space is only allocated in attribute search, you can't chain attribute certs. They don't chain.
I'm not going up the chain of the attribute certs. I'm going up a chain of the signed attestations. These. And then there is a question of what namespace are these? I agree. But but we have a natural namespace, which is the IP identifier and the ASN. Here you go, Jeff. And at least Jeff and I are used to storing these madly to run them for research. And I somehow think they make a very natural namespace. We're also going to be run by other means. I think Jeff wants to speak to the point.
Sure. I think the problem is I lost you at the point where you talk about binding two other certificates, an attribute certificate and identity certificate, together with a signature that somehow is derived from a private key associated with one of the identity certificates. A resulting thing like that is not something that PKIs deal with from a chaining perspective. It can be a digitally signed blob of bits that you verify, but we only chain certificates, and in fact, we only chain public key certificates, not something else. So it would be a new thingy of some sort, and I'm having a hard time relating to that.
Your turn. Yeah, just a quick comment, please, Jeff, because
I'll be really quick.
Out of time.
As far as I can see, what Randy is saying here is that there is an implicit chaining inside the series of attribute certificates up the food chain by nature of aggregates and more specifics, that if I see down at an ISP level a particular prefix, then I effectively search through the repository for an attribute certificate that expresses an aggregate of that. My question to Randy, though, was, while I can see that in the address space, how precisely does that work in the AS number space? Or are you assuming AS number blob arrangements? Or is this to be further work?
Sorry.
Boom, boom. AS numbers are very like the IP space. They don't have dots in the middle of them. But IANA does hand out blocks of them to the RIRs. So there are ranges of integers.
So you would say it's basically just the range search, and it would use the same thing as an implicit parent chaining that's going on here.
Stimmt.
Okay.
I will fess up that I haven't... you're at the edge of how I've thought this out. And so, Steve, okay? You're at the edge of how far I've thought this out. And luckily, I think we have a couple more meetings in the next 5 days to beat on each other further on it. But this maps the business and social relationships that we actually have. It's intuitive to us. But again, we're harping on this stuff when this presentation was about supposed to be on the router security problem. George, bail me out.
Okay, thank you very much, Randy. Next up, we have George Michelson. Who will give us an update on the APNIC resource certification.
1, 2, 1, 2.
Do you want to talk?
I would like to talk.
Okay, this is a rather hurriedly put together slide pack that's essentially for a workshop we're going to be doing next week, a closed activity, but it's a fairly good reflection of the current status of the work we have been doing. So I'm going to cover what are our current goals and approach. It's using OpenSSL, so I've got quite a lot of stuff about that, some examples of the activity and where we think we're going to go next. So the immediate short-term goals that we were looking at were to try and get something that was the demonstrator, something that would get us off first base, get code out there into the community with a prime focus on using free and open source. We really badly wanted to avoid re-implementing anything. Now, we have a body of code that we do in-house, and it's built around Perl using the mod Perl extension to Apache 2. That's a quite large investment we've made in a coding methodology over the last 2 to 2.5 years, and it's worked very well for us. So we were also looking to make use of that same mechanism. That means that it had to fit in with this thing we're calling the forms framework, which is a particular way we're developing code in APNIC. But we're actually very interested in some trends in the wider community. We've recently started looking at ways of doing REST, which is a very simple web-based application coding method. You're using the four primitives in the web, the get, put, post, delete function, and namespaces, and that's really all you do. We were looking at using XML as an encoding on the wire because there is so much code out there that you can use to do XML parsing and processing. And we're interested in the AJAX idea because if you can pump the load onto the client side and make things happen on people's own line rather than yours, that lets you get rid of quite a lot of the problems. So we've been doing this bootstrap using shell and Perl command line tools and simultaneously looking at some extensions to our coding framework to support the basic infrastructure. So I've got to say the infrastructure work, this is really primitive stuff. How do we handle a cert? Where do we store it? How do we parse it? How do we make statements about it in terms of its validity? It's not up at the service level where we say this is a valid RFC 3779 cert. It's much lower than that at this stage. But we've been able to leverage some experience in the bootstrap phase. In particular, we actually found there's some quite good code out there. There's a library called convert-asn1, which is fairly self-consistent. And what it does is it maps ASN1 code into a Perl hash structure. And it actually had a module for parsing X509 certificates that was just a test demonstrator. But it's actually quite good. Although it's very badly documented, the code worked very well. And we were able to use this to understand how to construct ASN1 sequences and then interact with them. And we targeted OpenSSL quite deliberately because we thought that was by far the most popular vehicle out there for interacting with crypto activity. So we're using the command line tool. We thought long and hard about going straight into the OpenSSL coding API. I don't know if any of you have ever had to look at this, but it is a frighteningly complicated library. It's unbelievably bizarre what Tim and Eric do to make SSL happen, and their interface is very, very confusing. It has asynchronous I.O. abstractions, it will make your tea, it will cut your hair, it does everything, and it's very poorly documented. So we just basically steered clear of that, and instead we're looking at using its command line interface. So we get very basic CA level functions. We can generate requests, we can sign requests, we can issue a CRL, and we can do basic SHA1 class signing very straightforwardly. Okay, so verification, that's also built into this tool. If you present a well-formed certificate, the certificate chain, the CRLs, you can say, is this cert okay? Problem is, they've written the verification in a way that doesn't really understand extensions. There isn't, if you think about it, how can you write a generic tool which is going to understand a totally arbitrary extension? You can't. So there are a few problems there with how much it can verify the extension fields that you add to a certificate. And what we've basically had to recognize is that this is an inherent, at this stage for us, this is an inherently two-phase process. We're going to verify the crypto componentry, but the payload, the extensions that refer to resources, we'll have to do out of band by looking at them ourselves. The other thing we're getting is some tools to convert from PEM ASCII encoded form to the DER, the on-the-wire binary encoding. You get some debug opportunities from this to actually look at things, and the Perl abstractions made a big difficult, big advantage to us. But there is that problem that it's undocumented and it's pretty complicated. So just a quick overview. The way OpenSSL configuration works, it's got an MS-DOS config format. You actually define blocked elements in a config file. You give the block a name, and then you do a variable value assignment. And we found that there's an option to add an extra config file, and so we've decided that we will construct our extensions to RFC 3779 as an external config and then pass it in. And there's this rather weird hack they've got where you encode in this config file the OID string, you then put in any flags about its criticality or its importance or what colour of milk you drink, and then you say the rest is a DER encoded sequence, and you just embed the hex as a series of colon-separated objects. So if you've got ASN1 and you can reparse it into a hex string sequence and you know the OID tag it's meant to be under, you can bang any extension into this framework and use it to construct a signing. So an example would be, here's an arbitrary member. They've got one ASN, 17814, and they've got a /20 of space. So using this mechanism, this is what it would look like in the encoding in a config file to run through OpenSSL. Do you have an eyeball zoomer? Right. So we've defined an arbitrary extension name in the configuration file, and we have some mandatory components that the RFC says we have to have. So we must pass down the CA bit. That's a requirement because you've got to use these certificates to generate other certificates. The subject key identifier has got to be put in as a hash. The authority key identifier must be present always. And you've got a key usage string, and there's a bunch of functions that you can do. The critical here is the interesting one. This has the behavior of making people not be able to do some things with your cert. It kind of puts restrictions for well-behaved software. I will say that I have suspicions there are hacks out there that ignore critical flags and do things with or without them. But in a community of well-behaved people, I think these flags are quite good. Sorry, Steve, is that possibly me being naughty, or is that a fair observation, that they're more mandatory but only if you play the rules?
I suspect from what we've seen that most widely used applications, in fact, will bar on a certificate with a critical extension rate.
Yeah. I noticed there were some tools out there that said, oh, I noticed you couldn't do XYZ with the certificate after you got it, but I wrote this thing to rewrite everything in it. And I sort of thought, well, I don't understand how that can work under crypto, but if you're happy, that's good for you. So people think there are things they can do. Anyway, the important stuff is actually the second set. These are the mandatory extensions that aren't known about in the set of attributes OpenSSL has. So there's an OID tag for one field here, and then a string of value. And then there are two which are actually defined by the RFC, and these are the IPv4 address and IPv6 address components and the ASN components, which both of which are critical. And this, if your ASN1 is as good as mine was 20 years ago but is not now, says something like sequence of, string of, number of, and encodes a representation of that prefix. To give you an example of what we get from the Perl, in the cert running program, we get logically to just do a configuration print of a PDU element against an OID. And the PDU, well, that's the string equivalent of the stuff we were seeing before. Does my voice not reach this microphone from over here? Sorry about that. If you look at another instance here, you get a hash array which consists of a high-level identifier that's in the ASN1 and then has the decode value there of the OID that's going to be represented. That's actually payload. And this is the instance of data we were looking at the first one. The 252932 instance is the policy identifier, and this is its payload value. That's an assigned number that is managed by IANA, I believe. In fact, I think even Steve may run the registry that assigns those. Yes? No? PKIX registry?
Russ has.
Oh, Russ does it. Yeah, so Russ assigned that number. Okay, so a cert creation act is a command line. You're doing a call of a CA function. You're passing in your own config, but then we're passing in an extension file and saying use inside that the extensions that are marked with this tag, and then some guff to give a certificate in and out. And it's just absolutely normal command line arguments for certificate processing. You could look on 100 web pages, how do I make my own certificate, and see this command line sequence with very small modifications. It's very, very straightforward. Okay, so for the resource signing function, we basically copped out in the short term. We weren't comfortable with the ASN1 part of encoding these objects because we didn't yet have a library that could do things with them. And it's not that we don't think ASN1 would work on the wire in a router, but we're kind of one step back. And we've just basically modelled the resource signing phase as constructing an SHA1 sign across a body of text. We're doing detached signature. So we've bypassed the issue of what ROAs are like, how to manipulate them, still coming up there. And we can actually sign anything. And we have, for instance, tested signing an RPSL object. There is a problem in the toolkit that if you want to apply the verify function, you must have the public key in DER format, in the ASN1 format. I don't know if you've ever seen how OpenSSL passes private keys around, but that's not the form it's routinely made available in. It's usually made available as a textual dump of the elements followed by a body of base64 encoded hex. And you have to do the conversion into ASN1 if you want to use its command tool to do a verify. And it doesn't tell you that anywhere in its Docker, which was a bit painful. So we're expecting we will have to put some tools into our own facilities to provide this for people to help you bootstrap doing these test functions. If you actually want to see one of these babies, this is what an example certificate looks like. Can you all see that? Can you all read that?
Yeah.
Great.
So
we're deliberately using a name which is quite clearly not a valid do not use this in the wild name. We've got short life validity, so we're not issuing long-lived resources. Again, that was quite deliberate. We wanted to get into a cycle of having aged certificates that people could check against. You've got a whole bunch of public key modulus. You've got some mandatory components. And down here, you have a typo because the people that submitted the code into OpenSSL got one finger wrong. And instead of SBGP, it's SBQP. And almost every OpenSSL out there is going to see that string until one minor upgrade goes through. We passed in a fix for that. You cannot actually see the elements. They present as arbitrary binary data, which is a bit of a problem. And we actually expect we'll have to write some code and submit it to OpenSSL community to present this in a structured manner and show people what the elements are so that you can do textual extraction, manipulate it yourself. And then you get the actual certificate as a bunch of text at the end. So the current status, well, what we did is we took all of the top-level resources that we've given out to our membership and we generated certificate instances for all of them. Our own file is about 8 to 10K of text, and that is a single certificate that covers the entire space that we have responsibility for. We can do somewhere around 1,000 signings in 30 minutes. Not that I would suggest in your wildest dreams you should re-sign the entire state of the world in one hit. That's silly. But if you have to, it's actually not very expensive.
On what?
On a Dell 1750, so I guess that's a 2-gig CPU. It's really low cost. Most of your time is spent doing I.O., actually, because the crypto component of this thing is very, very small. Yeah, I don't entirely understand why it is that I keep seeing the same numbers coming up as the public key modulus in this thing, and I'm starting to wonder if every single certificate in the world has exactly the same relatively prime number in it. Isn't that bad?
Actually, it's not the modulus, it's the exponent.
And it does, it really doesn't matter? It just really surprised me that we're taught that the way this stuff works is that you have huge numbers of prime numbers or relatively prime numbers, but we all use the same one.
Yeah, it's not the modulus, because the way RSA is set up and the modulus is actually your public key.
Right.
But the public exponent that's used, E, is... It can be any one of a variety of things. It's just that 2 to the 16th minus 1 is a good choice.
Steve, I dropped out of school early and cleaned bottles in a biology lab before uni. I mean, basically, at this point, if you say, trust me, it's okay.
It's a good number.
Thank you.
Trust me.
Yeah. I dropped $200 worth of glassware one day, and they were very cross with me, so I didn't do too well in that job. But hey, I went to the beach 100 times in 1 year. Okay, so this is explicitly a non-production CA. Now, the other thing about this is that we've deliberately made these certificate names a blind. We haven't given people institutional names. I don't know what your telco is. We have created this space using names based on this arbitrary number field of 128-bit numbers, and we chose completely at random this prefix, FC00. We just thought it was a really nice number space to use. So every one of these certificates has a 40-bit centrally assigned unique local identifier magically associated with it as a value. You can actually work out who it is, because if you just plug the AS or the IP into who is, you'll find out who's got it. But we are not making a data dump here. These are effectively neutralized, they're flattened, and we think there is potential in deliberately having certificates with anonymous names. Now, that is in no sense an RIR policy, and there are many reasons, as you've just seen from Randy and Steve, to actually think about names that get attached to these things. This is important. But for this stage, we're playing with effectively artificial flat namespace. We just thought it was useful. We have also made the configuration files and the private keys available. Never, ever give people your private keys. However, we are, because if you want to play with this stuff, you need the private key in order to do the signing. So our database, and I've put the URL up there, and it is in fact here, has, for every certificate, it has the private key, so that you could download these and pretend to be that person and use that certificate to do signings and tests. When we go live, we won't do that. I think that's about it. We're just starting to come up to speed on our own framework to manipulate these things, so we expect to be maintaining some progress on that. We're about 3 months behind with some other stuff, but we're going to have our facilities able to manipulate these objects and demonstration code that we will be giving out to people. And the next steps, well, we've got some test certs from BBN. Charles Gardner has actually been amazing. He's gone through about 5 iterations of reissuing tests, checking off stuff, verifying stuff. So we have a really nice body of code from outside that we're going to be working with. And we want to put up this little demonstrator to give people a chance to pick some numbers, be a certificate, make rowers, do validations, even make some bogus certs and verify that you can show that it's not valid. And then we're going to be putting up a timeline to actually get this stuff out the door. But a lot of this is subject to other work, like completion of our coding framework. That's it, folks.
Okay. Any more?
Randy Bush, IJ.
Hello, Randy.
Hey, George.
How are you going?
Not bad, and mostly because...
I'm glad. We're out of time now. Bye.
I'm really cheered. No. It was a compliment. That the RIRs, and particularly Opinion, since this is my home region, strangely enough, is out in the lead getting this done, because this is long lead time stuff, and there's going to be some Monday morning we're going to wake up where we have serious routing attacks, and this stuff has to have all been done beforehand. And whereas waving the money at the vendors isn't solving the problem for us, you're doing the substrate that has to be done first. And thank you.
Well, as the crash dummy here, I'd say that it's really comforting the open source tools are going to meet the goal. It's a little worrying about some of the behaviours, but it's not a big step to give them back some food that improves the quality of what they're doing. So I'd be fairly confident that what we get out the door may not be the fastest or the best, but it's definitely going to fly. I really don't think the community is going to have a problem here. I think we can fulfil the role that's needed.
Okay, thank you very much, George. So this brings us to the end of the first session of the Routing SIG. We have the break now. After the break, we have those three sessions to entice you back. Hope you'll come back for the second half in about 20 minutes' time. Thank you.